All right, welcome to class. Before we dive in, are there comments, questions, concerns, or other things for me? Yes?
I have a visual thing.
All right.
So one thing I've never gotten is you can focus on near and far objects.
Uh-huh.
And you can still do that even if you only have one eye open.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand how the distance to an object matters if it's all just photons coming into your eye from different angles.
Yeah. Let's talk about focus. So first, let's talk about how the eye doesn't work, but if it did, this wouldn't be a problem. Imagine we had an eye with a retina back here, and we just had a single point as the pupil. If we had just a single point as a pupil, then a near object and a far object, a near object and a far object, both of them, for any given point, the rays would enter there and they would hit some particular location on the retina. And it wouldn't matter whether they were near or far away, they would have only one point in the world, would have one point on the retina. But we don't have a single point, we have instead an opening. And so this single point on the object, if it goes through a different part of the eye, would hit a different part of the retina. And that would make it out of focus, because we wouldn't have one part of the retina that's seeing that part of the world. So we use lenses. And so as the photon hits here, it bends. And depending on what angle it hits the lens, it will bend in a different direction, so they can all be focused on one spot. Okay? But how much should it bend? If it bends too much, it will focus too low and get sort of fuzzy. If it bends too little, it will focus too far and get fuzzy. And this far object, the rays, the different lines from a single point on the object come in at a different angle. They're more parallel coming in. And so they need to bend less to focus. So the same focus that would cause this to focus down to just one point will cause this to focus down also to just one point, but a point back behind the retina, causing us to see a fuzzy image. Does this answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
Black lasers, why no lasers?
Why didn't, sorry, what?
Black lasers.
What about them?
Why?
Why are there black lasers?
Are there black lasers?
Yeah, there are many black lasers.
Do they subtract light?
No, they're just outside the visible spectrum. The majority of lasers we use for most purposes are outside the visible spectrum, as it turns out.
Okay, so what I meant was a light that...
Why are there no negative lights?
It's darkness, yeah, like on the assignment.
Yeah, yeah. So I think only two of you did negative lights on the assignment. But on the assignment, we said, what if the light has negative value and it will make the world darker? Wouldn't that be cool? And there are some weird things to think about if that did exist in the world, right? Your shadow would be brighter than the space around it. But basically, the problem is that light is created by photons, not by antiphotons. Right? There aren't antiphotons. There is no antimatter equivalent of a photon, or that is to say, the photons emitted by antimatter are also photons. So there is nothing that cancels out a photon. You could only have them or not. And because of that, there's nothing we can project into the world, besides paint perhaps, that will cause fewer photons to be bounced back. Yes?
For the home?
Yeah.
I'm looking at this mission.
Two or three?
The
one that was due last week or the one that's due in 2 weeks? Okay.
It's only showing 35 points in the retired
part.
And it's not saying not working for the other.
Yeah. So how does this work? So this is partly just how things get graded, but let's talk about this a little bit. Well, the main problem I have here is I run your program against all the images and see which one gets generated, and then I try to figure out which features you implemented. For homework 2, this was easy. If you didn't implement the feature, nothing drew. But for homework 3, or sorry, for homework 1, it was easy. But for homework 2, usually if it doesn't work, it draws me something. It's just not what I wanted to see. And so if it was did something that was nothing like what I was supposed to do, I didn't say anything at all. I also didn't say anything at all if you didn't generate the picture. So it's only if it was fairly close that you get any feedback. If you are curious to see what happened, I'm happy to share that in office hours or Piazza poster, however you want to get that. I unfortunately don't have a simple mechanism of getting them all back to you. I keep working on that and keep getting stuck with random server permission things. Anyway, I'm sorry that isn't a good answer. There were a fairly large number of really bad pictures. And a fairly large number of just no picture at all. For example, there is, like last time I had a bunch of random triangles. For this one I had a, let's randomly try to do, oh wait, this is the wrong homework assignment. Yeah. So for this one I said, you're supposed to be able to load MV. And so I made a file that generates a random triangle and applies a random load MV. And draws that, then makes another random triangle, another random load MV, and draws both triangles. Then another random triangle, another random load MV, and draws all three triangles, and keeps going until, I don't know, I think 12 or something. And almost a third of your programs crashed when trying to run that program. I don't know why.
For the matrix multiplications, I know a weird thing, how mathematically you're supposed to go like right to left.
Yep.
For to get them to generate the images, I had to go like left to right. Do you know anything about that?
There are lots of reasons. So it turns out that everything you do with matrices can go the other way if you do your multiplications backwards. And so my guess is your multiply was multiplying backwards. Or you're multiplying row vectors instead of column vectors. There's lots of ways that you could end up the other orientation. But the standard matrix multiply with column vectors being multiplied on the left, you want them to go one direction. For other things, you want them to go the other. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised. And there's probably some part in your code we can say, oh, that's wrong. That's why it works backwards. But if it works backwards, it works. Yes?
Can you go over questions?
Oh, yeah. I had busy when quizzes came up, so I didn't go to look at the quiz. Let's hope it's not going to embarrass me. It is, isn't it? It is, yeah. All right. For some clipping plane and square, so this is about, there's the information about the thing. So suppose you're seeing because there's two coplanar right triangles adjoining to make a square and two clipping planes. Also assume you always convert any clipped results to triangles. For some fixed clipping plane and square configuration, which of the following could change the number of triangles you end up with? Changing which of the two options used when turning quads into triangles, changing which of the two orders used when applying the clipping planes. And they're both correct. So let's consider an example. So all right, we have two triangles forming a square. And we have two clipping planes. And so let's just consider, let's start with this clipping plane. Okay. So this clipping plane should cause me to generate triangles like this, but I could also do it like that instead, and I get rid of these pieces. Okay. And then if I think about another clipping plane here, you notice the number of triangles I end up with depends on how many I started with, right? So these two each turn into two again, but only one of these does. If I had split this the other way, I would have had one more triangle, okay? So this is one example, a simple example of how the order I apply them in can change the answers. Is if my clipping planes are here and here. If I do the farther out one first, I will end up with more triangles than otherwise, right? Such as this, because then I will end up having more triangles. There are many other examples in these cases, but these are a few that came to mind. Does this answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
So on number 7,
yeah.
Just checking with my notes, and I don't understand exactly how 7.6 is like derived from there.
I'm happy to see that for once my fill in the blank was gotten correct by the majority of people. Anyway, so at least I have some confidence I didn't do the math horribly wrong. So let's talk about how this works. All right. So we want the sine distance between 2, 3, 4 and this plane. Okay. So we have a point 2, 3, 4. And we have a plane is 0.6x plus 0.8y. Sorry?
0z
plus 4 equals 0. Okay? So technically the first thing I should do is normalize the normal of my plane. Because distance only works if it's normal. Fortunately, this is already unit length. 0.6 squared is 0.36, 0.8 squared is 0.64. You add those together, you get 1. Huzzah! All right. So there's no normalization to do. So I already have a unit length normal. Okay. And so now I need to know what is the value I get here for this point. So I'm just going to multiply in a 2, a 3, and a 4 into this equation. And so that's going to be a 0. That's still plus 4. 0.8 plus 3 is 2.4. 0.6 plus 2 is 1.2. And then I add those all up together to find out my depth equation here is, that's 7.6. And that is the answer. Isn't it? Did I do something wrong?
Okay. That is what the answer was. So from what we have talked about, why do you add on the 4 at the end? Like,
because that's part of the equation.
So then, how is this distance?
This is how far this point is from this plane.
Okay.
We could try plotting it out carefully if we want and see if it works out. All right, so here we have coordinate system 0, 0. Since z is not part of the plane equation, we're not going to worry about z. Okay, so I have some point 1, 2 and x, 1, 2, 3 and y. Here is the point. Okay, and then I have this plane equation. All right, so this plane equation, I know I have a normal that points in x and y. But what point does it go through? Right? What is a point on this plane? So I can solve for lots of different points on this plane. Let's consider, for example, if y was 0. Okay, so if y and z are both 0, then what x makes this hold? That would be 0.6x plus 4 equals 0, which means that x equals 4 divided by 0.6. I totally should have done x equals 0 instead. Thank you. Which is going to be in the neighborhood of, what's that, like negative 7-ish, something like that. So I have, way down here I have a point on the plane, and my plane is close to being a left-right plane, but a little bit more left than right. Okay, so my plane goes something like this, where this is the positive side of the plane. And then how far away are these? They are 7.6.
Okay.
It's yes?
X equals negative 7 that way.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah, sorry. You're right. X equals negative 7 would be over here. And great. Same picture almost. Yes?
I have a question about, I don't know how this comes in, but there's like that formula where like you pick an arbitrary cube on the plane, and then you like draw like the
Yeah. Yep. So this will give us the same answer. So if we were to take this point, I guess we need to know what this point really is. So that's going to be, that's the same thing as 40 divided by 6, which is the same thing as 20 divided by 3, which is the same thing as, what is that number? That's going to be something 0.666. That's going to be 6. All right. So I have this point on the plane. I have negative 6.666, etc., 0, 0, is on the plane. And I have my point, 2, 3, 4. Okay. I could then take the difference of these two, so I could subtract these two and multiply that by the normal. So I need to take the subtraction of these two. I could do that in either order. Let's do it this way, negative 4.666. I have to subtract. All right, so I have to go point minus point. So I'm going to say negative 8.666, negative 3, negative 4. So I have this point, and now I have to multiply that by my normal of 0.6, 0.80, and do the dot product of these two, okay? And as we go through that, we'll end up with 7.6 again. I don't want to go through the math, but we will. No, because if we're having a point, then we're not using the equation, just the normal. But the math will turn out to be exactly the same. Mutandis, mutandis. Other questions? All right. So, our topic for the day is ray tracing. We'll have more ray tracing in more days, but we're going to try to go through a lot of it. So we talked last time about ray plane and ray sphere intersections, and now we can use them to find what things are bumping into. Pardon me. If you ever wanted a recording of me blowing my nose, you now have it. So we have ray plane, ray sphere intersections, then we could make ray other thing intersections with some variation on that. To find where an intersection is, but that is not enough to draw a picture. Okay, we can make an okay picture finding those, and then using the same sort of lighting equations we talked about for rasterizing. But usually, when we're doing ray tracing, we try to do fancier things. Okay, so if we think about, let's think about a 2D scene, because I can draw it correctly. Let's suppose we have a version of the Cornell box. Okay. We have an enclosed space with some sort of light on the ceiling and some sort of circle or sphere sitting in it. And I want to know what color is this pixel right there, or that portion of the scene. I assume the camera has decided that is something in the scene. I need to know what color to give it. So one way to do this is to say, well, there's a light source here and here is the object. And so clearly, compute the Lambert's law or whatever, and I come out with its bright light. But then I could say, actually, no, it's not, because there's a shadow. Okay? How do I know there's a shadow? What is a shadow? Well, shadows don't exist. This is one of the things to understand. Shadows are not physical things. Shadows are artifacts caused by something getting in the way. Okay? And what did the thing get in the way of? It got in the way of light. So photons did not reach that spot because they hit something else first. Ray tracing, we usually do this backwards. One of the nice behaviors about light is almost all materials, as in virtually everything in the universe, treats light symmetrically. Okay? So if it blocks light from one direction, it blocks light exactly as much from the other direction. The notion of a one-way mirror is fiction. It doesn't exist, right? If light has a 50% chance of bouncing going in, it has a 50% chance of bouncing going out. That's just how the world works. So I could try to shoot all of the photons that this light shoots out into the scene and see where they end up. But I could also say, I know I need to do this thing. I am going to try to figure out if it's in shadow. And the way I'm going to try to figure out if it's in shadow is after I hit it, I'm going to do another ray trace. I'm going to ray trace towards the light. It's going to shoot a second ray from the point of intersection and see if it bumps into something before it bumps into the light. Okay? And if it does, that light is invisible here. And if it doesn't, it is. And thus, I can cause this spot to be in shadow and this spot to be in shadow, but this spot to not. And I will end up having shadows appear in my scene. Okay? So these are things we would call a shadow ray. It's a ray we generate not for the purpose of determining color on the pixel of the screen, but for deciding is the pixel we already found in shadow or not. Okay, yes?
Is one by glass really not a thing?
Is what?
Is one by glass like really not a thing?
Yeah, it really isn't a thing. What that is it's usually something like 70% reflective, 30% transmissive, and then we just make one side brightly lit, the other darkly lit, and trust on the eye to see the reflection and not the dim thing on the other side. Yeah?
Is there any computational advantage to doing it from the object to the source of light as opposed to the other way around?
Yes, because I don't need to illuminate anything that I'm not going to see. Okay, so as we think about ray tracing, we had some camera and it was shooting a ray out into the world. What is the chance that I randomly shot a photon from the light to that spot? Oh, maybe I misunderstood your question. What is the chance I randomly shot a photon from the light to that spot when I was shooting all the photons? Virtually nil. Right, so I have to have some sort of approximation or something, but I could also say I know this spot, I know the light. Now, does it matter whether you say, oh, there's this ray instead? That is equivalent. Although we almost always do this way, because it lets us do things like infinitely far away suns and so on instead. But if it's local, then you could just draw the ray from the other side. The math would be exactly the same. Yes?
So the one-way glass is just like you're trying to look outside at night and your room is very brightly lit.
Yep, same phenomena. Yeah.
Are we doing it twice? Are we doing it from the light down and then back up for shadow, or just one time?
We typically do from eye through the pixel into the scene. That's one ray. Okay. And then we typically do from there towards the light. That's a second ray.
So you're never doing light towards the object. You're only doing object towards the light.
You could do this one backwards if you wanted. The math turns out to be exactly the same, and so we typically do it this way. Partly because it turns out that from the scene into other things is going to be a more general way of solving most problems. Yes?
So right now it's like you're either in the shadow or you're not.
Correct.
So that just means that the shadow's all black.
Correct, unless there's other light sources.
Yeah, so that's cool.
Right? If I add in another light source over here, then I'm going to need to do two shadow rays, one to each of them.
So we're assuming that light doesn't bounce off of the side of the bomb.
Yeah, we'll start assuming that in a moment. For now, we're assuming it doesn't. Okay? Yeah?
I guess I'm still a little confused how this like combines with the thing you talked about last week where you just shoot the ray from your eye to each.
Yeah, so I shoot the eye from... through each pixel into the scene.
Right.
And when I'm done, I know a point in the scene that I can see and what pixel it belongs to.
So that's like where the first ray is.
And that's where the first ray starts. Yeah, so this point here would be a ray plane intersection where it bumped into the floor.
Okay.
And from that intersection point, I'm now going to shoot a shadow ray.
So that's to like figure out what color
to figure out what color, is it in shadow or not? It's how bright is it and so on. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
The light that you have there is not like a point.
That's true. So which point do I shoot this ray towards? Okay, it turns out that I could like try to make some sort of cone shape, but cone sphere intersection is a lot messier than ray sphere intersection. So much so that's just almost never an efficient thing to do. So we could say, oh, you know what? Let's pretend like this was a whole bunch of little points all in a row. And we'll shoot a whole bunch of different shadow rays, one at each of them. Okay? And so we could do that instead. And that would get closer to being correct. Okay? That would give us an addition of this soft shadow and the penumbra where it goes from being all the way shadowed to all the way not, and so on. Which the real world commonly has. If you look at the lights in this room, none of them are points, or even vaguely close to points. They're vaguely close to lines, but they're more big areas, right? Because if I were ray tracing this room, how do I know how much light hits any given point in the scene? I would have to check all of the lights, and then many points in each of the light, and see how much each of them is contributing. Yes?
This might be just like a limitation of this example, but so if we were doing sort of the... if we're drawing a ray from the light to sort of that point,
yeah.
Wouldn't that point be be like taken by the fact that the sphere gets intersected first, and so we'd actually.
That is the point. The sphere casts a shadow.
Right.
So I want to find the sphere first.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha.
That tells me I have a shadow. If I don't find the sphere first, then I'm not in shadow, right? So if I were to do the same thing from this point, it has completely uninterrupted access to the light.
So you don't need to do the shadow
rays? I still throw the shadow rays, they just don't find an intersection. I don't know whether I'm in a shadowy place or a non-shadowy place until I shoot the shadow ray. Yes?
So in this case, let's say you're at that second point that you drew.
Yeah.
If you were to shoot all of them to all those points, do you stop when you hit the first one, or does it matter like how many you hit?
I mean, it does matter how many you hit, right? Because what if I shot the first one here, but then there was an object right there I just missed?
Yeah.
So I do need to shoot them all if I want to know exactly how much light there is. Now, I might at some point say, I've shot 15 and haven't hit anything yet, I'm done. And maybe the 16th would have found an object and made myself a little dimmer, right? I don't know. But that's an optimization. I stop at some point. I always stop at some point. Because real objects, like how many rays do I need to talk about an object? Arbitrarily large number. And so we always do it for a while and then stop. Okay? So, this is a beginning of how I think about illumination. In addition to thinking about what color is the thing I hit and how my illumination models work here, I also need to say, well, can I even see the light? But it gets more complicated than this. Okay? To see what I mean, but it gets more complicated than this, let's look at this picture from our reading. All right. Let's really properly look at it. So this is a ray trace scene, a 3D version of something similar to what I was drawing. We have one rectangular light source on the ceiling and a room. And you'll notice that nothing in the scene is black. Okay? And yet we look at it and we say, oh yes, there's one light source, I can sort of see that. But how did it know what colors to make everything else? For example, back here, why is that green? Yeah? Yeah, you know what color the wall we can't see is. How do you know that? Well, you can see it in the reflection. So I need to figure out how to draw those. I also need to figure out how to make that green wall make this wall look green. Right? What shape is this thing? Like, if I were to take a cross-sectional slice of that, what shape would it be? Guess cylindrical. You can tell that even though it can't see any lights. Right? So light gets into all parts of this scene. How does it do that? And so we're going to talk about how we make it to do that. How we approximate this effect. So, first let's talk about how physics really works. Okay, so I have some scene, and I have some source of photons. Those photons go all over the place, and they hit anything they want. And when they hit, some of them are absorbed, and others of them bounce away in randomish directions. And so everything they hit is glowing. Is emitting more photons. And then these photons, whatever they hit, they glow. And whenever they hit, they glow. Whenever they hit, they glow. And each time some photon hits something, most of the time, almost every object in the real world absorbs at least half of the photons. Some things absorb less, but typically it's quite a significant slice. So you get less photons each time, but they don't go all the way away. And there are so many photons emitted from a light. So many. It is hard to overstate how many photons come out of a light. Okay? And so even if a very, very small percentage of them eventually make it to where we're going, we still see some light. And it could have hit an arbitrary number of things first. If we're going to handle this in ray tracing, we have to be able to A, figure out where the photons were, and B, figure out once they hit something, where did they go? So we're going to start with B. Once they hit something, where did they go? And then we'll come back to A, how do we get them there? Okay. So, we have some object. We have photons that hit it. Where does this photon go? Almost all materials, with the exception of a few fluorescent things, almost all of the time, we can deal with this by saying the photon has a probability distribution function of what direction it is going to go next. Okay? And so there, it might go here with some probability and here with the others, and we'll often try to draw this with sort of longer for more likely directions. Okay? And so this would be the sort of thing we would expect for a specular shine. Okay? It sort of bounces, but a little bit of fuzz. This will make the shinies that we talked about with Fong and Blin. Okay? That doesn't have to be what we see. We might also have some chance of going in every direction because maybe we're combining that with Lambert. Okay? But we could also have weirder things. Like, for example, velvet is more likely to bounce if the light came in at a steep angle than if it didn't. Who knew? Right? There are all kinds of different approaches here. So in general, what do we need to know in order to compute this? In general, what we need to compute this is what is known as the bidirectional reflectance distribution function. All of these things are important. All of these words are important. Bidirectional. Because of how photons work, it doesn't, if I swap light and camera, I get the same chance of the light going there. So light goes the same direction in both directions. Same chance in both directions. So it's bidirectional, and since we can swap the camera and the light and get the same answer. It's reflectance, because we're talking only about the case where the photon comes in and goes out again. Not the case where it comes in, bounces around for a while, turns into energy in an electron cloud, pops out later. Just the case where it comes in and goes out. Okay? It's a distribution function because it gives me the probability for any given situation of getting a particular level of reflectance. Now, this article here almost immediately drops into, you know, math. And then there's all kinds of things about other functions in case you want, you know, the Helmholtz reciprocity function or so on. And then they have this, like, this little guide of three common kinds of BRDFs. Diffuse, glossy, and mirror. Okay? And then they have some simplified model of certain kinds of things, some of which we've talked about before. But the first thing I want to do is look at this function. We have a function of two values. What are those values? Those values are the incoming and outgoing angle relative to the normal. In general, changing either or both of those could change what's going on. So the models we looked at thus far, the Lambert law, doesn't care about the outgoing angle, only the incoming angle. Okay, so the angle to the light matters, the angle to the camera doesn't. We also looked at the Blin model, which cares about how these two are related to the normal, but not their absolute values, right? So if we make them both wider angles, they will stay the same. Both narrow angles stay the same. It's only their relative angle. But in general, we can have an object where they both matter. Let's try to construct an artificial example of why they might both matter. Let's suppose I have some object that if we zoomed in really, really far, looked sort of like this. Okay? And then let's suppose I were to paint these parts red and these parts blue. Now the angle you are looking at it will change its apparent color. If you're looking at it from directly above, it will look sort of purplish. If you get it from a very steep angle, you'll see almost only red. If you're looking at somewhere in between, you'll see some red and some of these walls, which I have black. So you see sort of a darker red. So the angle you are looking at it will change its apparent color. Okay? We would also have all kinds of shadows and things, and this isn't a really great example in the real world. But things like this at the microscopic scale are fairly common. This is why velvet does weird things. Velvet has a whole lot of little hairs, and they look different if you look at them dead on than if you look at them at a steep angle. Okay? It's also why like sunsets are red. It's a similar kind of idea. When you look through a whole lot of air, it looks redder than if you look through only a little air because the sun's directly above you. Okay? Same basic idea. The angle between you and the object, between the light and the object, can change its apparent view. And so we need to end up with a model that has two angles as well as the surface, normal, to tell me what things look like. Question?
Could you just re-clarify again what the bidirectional part means?
The bidirectional means I will get the same probability if I swap the position of the camera and the light. And the light.
Yeah, so when you say same probability, like the...
I mean,
like
a photon... So what does this do? The distribution function says, for this situation, what percentage of these photons will make it into that camera? So it's going to give me something like 0.3 or whatever it is. It will be the same if I were to swap these. If I swap WI and WR, I get the same 0.3 or whatever it was. Other questions? Many things we interact with regularly have very complicated BRDFs. Textiles, for example, are notable. Sofas almost always have very complicated BRDFs. Question?
So are we going to define or find a definition for a BRDF for like every material we want to use?
If we want to render it accurately, we need to. We won't in this class. Okay? After you do like Lambert's Law and Blinfong, and you start, you know, maybe Cook Torrents you could sort of do, and then you get to something more complicated, like, I don't know, a silk sofa, and you realize that it's just so monstrously complicated, the correct way to do this is you take a whole lot of pictures from different angles and you combine them all. And really, this, like, you measure your BRDFs. We have actually, at UVA, we have at different times published papers, although the faculty have done that are no longer working at UVA, but we've had faculty publish papers on faster, better ways of measuring BRDFs in the real world. And you have big data files that essentially just sample this function from all different directions. And then you know how to draw it. But they tend to be big, messy data files, unless it's somehow a cleanly manufactured or homogeneous material. Yes?
Do the BRDFs that they generate from that end up being big, messy functions? Or
yep.
Okay.
I mean, we don't tend to turn them back into functions. We tend to leave them as data files if they're messy. Other questions? I should also comment, although describing these mathematically or in data files is complicated, our eyes understand them very well. Our experience learns things about BRDFs and learns, for example, about the angular sensitivity of the difference between a bruise and a bit of mud on somebody's face. And we will just instinctively say, oh, that looks like a bruise and that doesn't, and how did we know? Well, magic, right? And it is, if you try to like write out the BRDFs, you could say, oh, they're different. They're not obviously different necessarily, but you can figure out how they're different eventually. This is also why it is a lot harder to make makeup look good in a real person than on a screen. Because on the screen, you're removing most of the elements of the BRDF. You're giving one picture at a time. But a real person, it's interacting with all kinds of moving lights and so on. And it's much easier to tell, oh, they're wearing something on their face to make them look like that. They don't normally look like that, right? Anyway, because our brain is very good at noticing these, even if it isn't good at describing them. So they do matter if we're trying to think about highly advanced sorts of photorealistic rendering. However, we can do cool things without them. Or with only very simple ones, we can do images like this. Oh, that's the bad one that doesn't use the BRDF. Let's do the good one that does. All right, so we can do images like this because all this has is just a handful of things. Basically, glass, silver, some sort of glassy, silvery mix thing, and paint. And so we're gonna talk about those four. And hand wave away how we'll do the others to some degree, because they'll be built essentially out of these pieces. So before I move on, any more questions about BRDFs? All right, let's talk about the main ones, okay? We have diffuse, we have refractive, and we have reflective. Okay. Diffuse, refractive, and reflective. Diffuse has the following property. It is random where the next ray goes. Straight up random. Yeah, that's it. Okay, that was easy. Yes?
Is this random in the pseudo-random sense or random in the really random sense?
This is random in the most random thing we know about the universe, quantum physics, sense. Yes, because it's caused by quantum. It is also random in the highly chaotic system. We could predict part of it, but we don't know the data. So it has both of the natural kinds of random combined. Hooray! Okay, so what does this mean, right? If we have a diffuse object and we are shooting our ray into it and we hit something, where should we have to look? We have to look uniformly in every direction. Because any ray that hits it from any direction in the world, any light at all, could have bounced off and hit us. And so if we want to find where the light came from, we have to look everywhere because there isn't pattern. Okay? So although diffuse objects are easy to make crude approximations of, Lambert's law is very fast to approximate. If you want to get it right, it's extremely complicated to do because it bounces light everywhere. It is not well behaved. Okay? Let's do reflective next because it's the easiest to talk about. Refractive will be a little bit more complicated. Reflective. Okay, this just mirrors across the normal. Okay, so I have some object, it has a normal at some place. If a ray, and again this is bidirectional, so whether we think about this as a ray from the camera or a ray from the light, doesn't matter. If a ray comes in, I need to bounce it off at the same angle on the other side of the normal. Okay? Mirroring across normals is actually really easy with vector math. It's a dot product and subtraction. Dot product of multiplication and subtraction. So we can do this fairly efficiently, and we can make shiny things, mirrory things. If we want to make it not quite mirrory, we fuzz that a little bit. Okay, and that gives essentially the Blinn-Fong model. But if we want a true just mirror, we just bounce straight off. And this behaves like mirrored objects, or in general, like any sort of smooth metallic conductive material that causes photons to bounce off their interface. Yes?
So once we've figured out the BRDF, do we just simulate a bunch of photons coming from the lights?
Yeah, well actually we can do from the lights or the camera. We'll talk about both of those in a moment. I'm going to talk about all three of these common ones first, and then we'll talk about how we would use them. Okay? Refractive. This uses Snell's law. Does anybody remember Snell's law from high school? All right. Snell's law. If we have, let's say we have glass, and we have a photon coming in. Okay? Snell's law is actually complicated, but we're just going to use the simple part of it. Snell's part of it is simple. Snell's part says there's an index of refraction on both sides. The index of refraction is the relative speed of light through this material compared to through a vacuum. You probably didn't hear about it in that term because you were told speed of light is constant, and it is in a vacuum. It also is in glass, but it's a different constant there. Surprise! Right, anyway, so it goes slower through glass than through air. Because it goes slower, we mentioned this once before, but let's review it, right? If I try to walk in a straight line with my left leg moving slower than my right, I don't walk in a straight line. Because my left leg doesn't go as far and end up turning to the left. when the photon comes into glass and has to move slower once it's in the glass than it did when it was outside the glass, it has to turn to make that work. It has to turn into the glass to move slower as it comes across the boundary. Okay? Because as you have something, if you're moving slower on one side than the other, you're going to turn in towards it. Yes?
Is that a higher or lower index of refraction?
This would be a higher index of refraction. So we actually store the inverse of an inverse relationship between the speed of light. Yes. So this is going to be a higher index of refraction, often in the 1.4 range, although it varies a little bit. This will probably be approximately 1. Okay. And we actually store index of refraction. The particular units we use for index of refraction is based on using Snow's law, effectively. Makes the math easier rather than anything else. Okay. So we'll bend in, and then we exit the glass. We're going from slow to fast. Okay. So that means that I'm going to have to increase the angle. And so we have this behavior. The exact behavior that we have is, I don't think I added a link for this, Snell's law. Here we are. More at Wikipedia. Snell's law, also known as the Snell-Descartes law, has this behavior, okay? It says the ratio of the sines of the angles is equal to the ratio of the indexes of refraction. And so, ta-da, we can figure this out. There are more useful ways of modeling this for the purpose of graphics, but this is what works. Now, strange things happen if you need to increase an angle that's already big. Okay? Because remember that sine, it's a wave. And so if one of these functions, it could be that this ratio could be too big, or this ratio could be too big for one of these to have a meaningful answer. In particular, we could have the case where we were coming at such a steep angle already that to try to increase the sine wouldn't work, wouldn't keep us out of the object. In that case, we ignore Snell's law and we do total internal reflection instead. Okay, and so this is called total internal reflection. And total internal reflection is really important for one aspect of computer technology, fiber optics. The whole point of fiber optics is we make sure we're shooting stuff through something with a higher index of refraction at a steep enough angle it can never get out. And poof, it will just go forever. Okay, so we use this for that, but we also use it in graphics. Okay, so we have this idea of Snell's law for refraction. And we call this process where you change angle, but you're still going basically the same direction, refraction. Where you change angle, you're going the other way, reflection. Where refraction goes through, reflection does not. Questions about refraction? All right. So, how do we go about doing this? Let's start with the easy way. Okay, the easy way is I shoot my ray from the camera into the scene, and it hits some point. And then I shoot a fixed number of additional rays. Okay, I shoot the refraction ray, I shoot the reflection ray, and then I shoot a shadow ray towards each of the lights. Okay, and that's it. I do that and nothing else. This won't work for diffuse. I mean, the shadow ray is an approximation of diffuse. It's going to say the bright lights are the only ones I care about for diffuse objects. It won't give us that green back glow, so we'll have to talk about how we'll get there. But this is a simple way of making it work. And this will give us some reasonable images. It'll give us shadows, it'll give us shiny, it'll give us liquid, it'll give us glass. It won't give us complicated work. It doesn't work real well in indoor scenes with external lighting and so on. But if we have direct lighting in the scene, this will give us a pretty good approximation of what's going on. We don't always have to shoot all of these, of course. If our object is not transparent, we don't shoot refraction. If it's not reflected, shiny, we don't shoot reflection, and so on. But in general, we can shoot all of these rays to find out what our object is colored like. And then we combine these in some way based on the shadow is diffuse, the reflection is reflective, shininess, refraction is based on transmission. We combine those, we end up with the color of the pixel. And what do I mean by combine those? I mean, the refraction ray is going to go hit some other object and then repeat the whole process. Because I need to know what color it hit for reflection. Yes?
How many attempts do you do this for in a row? Do you do it like 3 or 4 times, or do you do it until you meet some kind of boundary?
Either of those are done. So typically, as we go along, we keep track of what percentage of this ray will make it back to the eye. Because usually it's nothing's 100% reflective or 100% diffuse. Okay. So typically we're losing some each of the way. So maybe it's only 50% reflective. Maybe this hits another 50% reflective, hits another 50% reflective. Once I get down to I'm only contributing 1/16th of the light, I may stop. Or I will say, I'll try for 8 depths and then I'll quit. And whatever I think the correct number of depths is. This will not always work out nicely. Let's actually consider an example from your coming homework. Where you'll just need to have to eventually approximate. So, in the ray tracer homework, we have a picture somewhere down here where we have shiny materials. Oh, that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to do this. All right, so this, oh well, that didn't zoom in at all. All right, let's see if I can make this work instead. All right. So in this picture, we have a diffuse ball between two shiny balls. And because the diffuse ball is in the way, we can't see the other shiny balls. So one shiny bounce is enough. And we also have a green light above and a white light below, huzzah, because, you know, making simple scenes. And then we have refractive things and so on. But this one, we have two shiny balls next to each other. Right? How many times do you keep bouncing back and forth between the shiny balls before you quit? A number. And we just say, do D bounces. Okay? And this is actually fairly common in graphics programs that are used for movies and so on as well. You say, stop after X, number of bounces. And so we can do that. All right. Other questions? All right. Now, this won't give us everything we'd ever want. Let's actually just look at the very next example. What if we have a rough shiny thing? Okay. What did I do here? In this picture, all that we did was we just shot in a random direction, not quite the one we thought we were shooting at. That's it. Okay. And it gives us this very pixelated, noisy image. Not a beautiful picture. Okay. It's not a bad picture, but it'll be different every time I take that picture, so I don't want to use it in animation or it'll look all noisy, staticky. Okay. But if I were to shoot a dozen rays here with slightly different directions and average their power, then I get a much cleaner picture. If I were to shoot 1,000 rays from the pixel and average their color, I get a much cleaner picture. And so often what I want to do there is I want to try to shoot all of the rays that could exist and average together what they do. Average them using the BRDF, right? So average their significance using the BRDF. And this causes us to really, we're really doing numerical integration. Ray tracing is really all about integrals. We almost never have to solve the integral because we can't. So we're going to do it approximately instead. So just as a brief reminder, integrals, right? What does an integral do? An integral is the sum of the area underneath a curve. Okay, so I have some curve Let's suppose, for example, this was the angle that the light was coming in at, and this was the light that was coming. And if I can add up all of the light over all of the angles, I know how bright the object should be. Okay? And this is what we want. We want to do this. And the basic system we've been talking so far is really approximating this by adding up, let's say this is the reflection, and this is the shadow, and we add those 2 points. We can do better if we take more points. Okay, so the basic way you were probably taught integration when you first learned it is, we imagine that we had a whole bunch of little rectangles and we add them up together. Okay? And we can, and then you probably learned about trapezoid rules and different approaches to this, and you've probably gratefully forgotten most of that. Huzzah. All right. This all is what we do in ray tracers. We do this all the time. Okay? But we do it fancier than you learned in calculus. Because I don't need to shoot a whole lot of rays out here where everything's dark. That's useless. It is more important to shoot rays where there is more light. It's less important to shoot rays where there is less light. Okay? And so what I want to do is I want to do something we call importance sampling. What is importance sampling? Importance sampling is focus where it's important. Shoot rays in the bright direction. So importance sampling, okay, we have whatever our function is. And what we want to do is you want to take very narrow slices in the areas that are bright and bigger slices in the areas that are dim. Okay? We want to shoot rays where it's bright and don't shoot rays where it's dim. The extreme version of this is the shadow ray. Shoot ray at the light. It's the brightest thing. Okay? I don't just want to do what's bright, though. I really want to do a multiple of what's bright and what my BRDF says is important. Okay? So what do I mean by importance? I mean bright, and I mean a high BRDF. Okay, so I want a high importance as far as it will contribute a lot to the light. High BRDF, the extreme example is I shoot reflection rays or transmission rays. It's the most likely direction to matter for glass or metal. And bright, that's the shadow ray. I shoot where it's brightest. If we generalize this a little bit, we can create something that will shoot a bunch of rays. We'll shoot more rays close-ish to bright things and fewer rays in areas we expect to be dark. And then we can actually do this adaptively. So I can shoot a handful of rays, and whichever ones are bright, I shoot more rays near them, and whichever of those are bright, I shoot more rays near them, but I keep randomly sampling from some places that weren't bright because maybe I missed a light. And I keep doing this until the artist says that's good enough. Okay? And this is actually how we do a lot of rendering. We shoot rays more or less at random into the scene until we say, yeah, that looks good. Okay? And better methods of importance sampling, better heuristics to guess where to shoot the ray, make faster, better ray tracers. And worse heuristics make worse ray tracers. So when you see a ray traced scene, I don't have it up anymore. When you see a ray traced scene, like the one we had here for global illumination, okay, you'll notice that the test scenes that people give will all have similar characteristics. You will have a few very bright light sources, and you have a few less important but very big light sources. So if you miss them, you still get a pretty good amount of light. But sometimes you get these things, these lensing effects. Those are harder to predict. Those are called caustics in general. And so there's actually all kinds of specialized rules about how do I generate those. And so if I want to make those, I'll shoot most of my rays from the camera into the scene, but shoot some of my rays from the light into the scene to see where the light mostly ends up, and then decide those areas are important so that when I secondarily shoot my rays from the camera into the scene, I know where I want to sample more from. And so we sometimes have this multi-pathway where we send some rays from the light, some rays from the camera. We use them to interact with each other to try to get a nice rendered scene. And you could ask, for example, why is that spot bright? And that has this weird behavior of, that is caused by light hitting the mirror, bouncing through the glass, and being focused on the wall. Okay? How do you know when you're looking at that point in the light that where you need to shoot rays is into one particular part of the glass ball? You either shot thousands of rays and happened to get lucky, or you earlier did some sort of pre-processing pass that decided that those are the important directions for that part of the scene. Okay? So those are what we typically do when we want to try to make photorealistic renderings. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yes?
It seems really slow.
Like, yeah.
What is the naive runtime on something like this?
Unbounded. I mean, yeah, no, it is hard to overstate how slow this can be. If your scene is nice and tidy, it can be quite quick, because you shoot a few rays and everything looks good. But if you want to get something that looks fairly involved, it can take a long time. I'm tempted to show you an example of a professional ray tracer running. Should I? Okay. Yeah, let's show you an example. So I will just quickly, hastily make an arbitrary scene. Let us see how quickly I can do this. I don't use this tool as often as I used to. I will make a random scene here. Let's make that. All right, let's use a good ray tracer. All right. Let me turn down the lights so you might be able to see vaguely what I'm doing. This is a Blender. It's an open source ray tracer and other tool, which is fairly good at what it does, I think. So we're going to take this, and let's start by just saying, let's draw this scene, okay? And for starters, it does a pretty good job right away, okay? And then every 10 seconds, it will update again as it comes along and decides what things ought to look like. Except, all right, and so every 10 seconds, we'll see some noise go away. This is a fairly advanced ray tracer. This is the LuxCore renderer, which does a lot of important sampling. It looks for noisy areas in the scene and tries to shoot more rays through those places and so on. But this is a really boring scene. So let's add some more interesting things. Let's add to this scene, how about we add ourselves a strange, let's just change this light. Let's move this light up here and change it to an area light and make it big. Where is the size? I'm used to running this in a much higher resolution. Sorry about that. Let's make it big. Okay, and now let's see what this looks like. Oh, I need to flip it over. Oh, I need to turn off the sky. The sky is brighter than my light. That's foolish. Let's turn off the sky. Okay. And so now I have this scene where I have the ball sitting here. Now the ball actually still has a checker color pattern on it, but it's so noisy you can't see it. Okay, and so if I want to see the checker color pattern, I'm going to have to run it the slower way. And you notice that most of these pixels are sort of like a random, it's either black or white. Either this happened to bump into something that saw the light or it didn't. As you run more and more iterations of this, we will gradually, slowly start to see that there is indeed a checker color pattern, checkerboard pattern. We can sort of see it in the half-lit areas right now. Okay, but as it runs many, many rays through every pixel, you'll be able to start picking up on that. This doesn't even have anything complicated. I don't have any mirrory, curvy things to cause weird caustics or anything. This is just like a ball, right? And I'm having to wait non-trivial amounts of time to see it look like a ball. This is one of the more efficient ones out there. I currently don't have it running off my graphics card, which would make it about 10 times faster because battery power. But it's a fairly fast one, yes. And then if I wanted to make it more fancy, right, I could and so on, because I happen to know how to use this reasonably well. But that's probably not worth our time. Yes?
So is the only reason these images look more realistic than the ones we're making is because they're bigger?
No. Okay. Let me show you what I mean by that. Let me change this to doing something like you were doing, right? This is This is what this same scene looks like using, say, Homework 2's rasterizer. This is actually better than Homework 2's rasterizer. Because Homework 2's rasterizer, with an ambient occlusion to make the shadow a little bit darker here, and shadow computation by shooting a little bit of extra rays, but it's ugly, right? I can get a little better by using a cheaper ray tracer that doesn't do as much work, but not a whole lot better, right? I can use a slightly an even better ray tracer. This is a pretty good ray tracer. It doesn't have everything Lux has, but Cycles is a pretty good one. It just does a single pass for each box. You see it sort of builds the image slowly, and it's going to give us a pretty good image of a ball sitting on a spot. This one, though, will fail pretty spectacularly if I make this ball glass, because we're going to see just the same kind of shadow we saw before. So let's just see that ray quickly. Let's come in here. Oh, didn't mean to do that. Let's change this into glass and see what this looks like. Okay, so now I have a glass ball instead of the ball I had before, and I can sort of see, I can see a reflection of the light because glass is partly reflective. I made it slightly rough glass, so I can sort of see this slightly fuzzy thing, and I can sort of see there's a little bit of caustic there. It's doing an okay job at knowing that light got focused, okay? But it's not as nice as I might hope, okay? And the more complicated I make this, the less it's going to work well for me, okay? Right, so if I were to use a fancier renderer, and then I'm going to have to change how I did the materials because this one doesn't use the same set of materials, sorry. All right, make this glass, and then go over here. All right, so if I use the fancier renderer, okay, it's going to do a better job at making the glass and making the caustics. You'll notice we actually have, sort of, it looks like we have two reflections here. One of those is the glass total internal reflection of the ground, and one of them is the light source up above, and these things actually exist in the real world. But you'll also notice this is a lot slower, right? It's sitting here, and it's thinking. Because it's doing more work. Also, I don't think you can even see it on the screen there. Let's see if I can make the room dark enough to show you the weird secondary effect. See these glowing pixels right here? What on earth is causing those? Until I have a whole lot more of them, it'll be really hard to know. There's probably something like internal reflection on the far side of the sphere and then bouncing off and seeing some copy of the light or something like that. Okay. Also notice you have some bright pixels. This is the term of art when you're talking about rendering, is we call these random bright pixels fireflies. That's what they're called. We've shot one pixel happen to shoot a ray in a way that saw the bright thing and all the pixels around it didn't. And it can actually take a long, long time for fireflies to go away. Because they may be really bright, but by random luck, they hit the important thing. And every other ray we shoot through that area doesn't hit it, and it just stays bright anyway. Getting these things to work well is quite complicated. But there are better and better versions of these ray tracers that come out. They all use versions of the same kind of algorithms. They're not doing fancier things. They're just doing it more efficiently. They're using better algorithms to select where the rays go, better algorithms for combining the rays when they find them, and so on. And, all right. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yes?
A lot of the images in the Homework 3 are 120 by 120 pixels. Is that just to keep the runtimes decently fast?
Yeah. And even that, some of you are going to be sad that they're that big. Yes?
What does the good ray tracer look like if you run it with 140 by 120 pixels?
It will create an excellent image very quickly.
I mean, will it look nice or will it look
bad? Well, it'll be pixelated. But, I mean, like, it will draw, so. Right, like, I mean, a lot of why the Homework doesn't look great is because of what we ask it to do, okay? So like, when your scene consists of like two balls next to each other, what can you do? They look like two balls next to each other, okay? So ray tracers become more interesting as scenes become more complicated. Like for example, the one that none of you are going to do. Okay, but I'll show it anyway. All right. So this scene, 1,000 spheres. It's stupid. Why would you ever draw 1,000 spheres? Okay. But you probably have trouble looking at that picture and knowing how the spheres are arranged in space, because all we have are colored lights and shadows. We don't have interactions of the objects. There's no sense of how close things are because we can't see how much of light bounces off one sphere and into another. If we were to do this with a global illumination ray tracer that shoots the rays in all other directions, we would suddenly have that extra cue. Their eye has learned to say what things are adjacent. And so it would still be a bunch of arbitrary spheres, but they would look more like spheres in real space because you have those extra cues your eyes are used to seeing. Other questions? All right. I realize I've gone through this without using as many, probably defining very many terms along the way. So let's just talk about a few terminology things that are worth knowing. So BRDF we talked about, okay? BRDF is the likelihood that a photon will bounce in any particular direction. Global illumination. Global illumination. Illumination. Is the term for we get light from things that aren't lights. Okay? So if we allow light to bounce off of a diffuse object and illuminate things, that's global illumination. Ambient occlusion is an approximation of global illumination. In particular, ambient occlusion says, I'm going to ignore lights and the real complexity of the world. I'm going to approximate the fact that things that are close together tend to be dark, because it's hard to get light into those crevices. As it sort of just says, let's imagine the universe glowed, and how bright would everything be if that were the case? Okay? So ambient occlusion is an approximation technique that's sometimes used. It can, as a first pass, sometimes help your important sampling, but often it's used if I don't have the patience to do proper global illumination. I do ambient occlusion instead, because I don't have to worry about lights at all. I just have to say, did I hit something or not? You can think of this as sort of be shoot random shadow rays only. So from an intersection point, I shoot 50 random shadow rays in random directions, and I see if they bump into something. If they do, I make it darker. If they don't, I make it lighter. And that will give us an approximation of ambient occlusion. So these terms are fairly often used. We also talked about refraction and reflection as well. So there's some terminology. 2 minutes. All right, what can we usefully do in 2 minutes? Yeah, all right. Let's preview. We'll spend some more time on this later. Projections. We introduced ray tracing by, say, imagine we have a raster and we shoot rays from the eye through the raster. What if we didn't make it flat? This is the basic idea of projections. So what if I said I have an eye and I put it inside a raster I've rolled up as a tube? What would that picture look like? Okay? I can make this shape any shape I want. It's just how do I generate my starting rays? Once I generate that first ray, ray tracing doesn't care what my camera's lens was shaped like. So I can wrap them around like this. I could say, you know what, I want to have this thing. It's going to be, I don't know, sort of like curved around me in some way, like a little piece of like you're using a tablecloth as a parachute or something, okay? Right. We can do this however you want, as long as we can end up generating raster coordinates for every point on some shape. And the shape we pick here will change what things look like. It'll change the perspective that we see. So we'll spend a little bit of time next time talking a little bit about projections. We'll talk about a few other related concepts that are important to understand for ray tracing. And then we'll move on to other topics. Question?
For generating our rays, what is the like definition of a plane of that we're passing rays through, like through the pixels? Like we have our eye as 0, 0, 0, but what's the direction of each ray?
So there are lots of ways of defining it, but typically we have a forward vector. We have a right vector and an up vector. And we just say any given pixel is some combination of right and up plus forward. And I actually have formulas for that in homework 3 that you can use. All right, I will see you all on Thursday.